Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last year alone, more than 4,100 people died from opioid overdose in Ohio. The Columbus Dispatch has reported that early data suggests that that number will be significantly higher this year. States and a handful of cities have responded with lawsuits. In Ohio, Attorney General Mike DeWine last week named five pharmaceutical companies for their alleged roles in creating and exacerbating Ohio's opioid crisis. Yesterday, the cities of Dayton and Lorain filed their own lawsuits that named both drug makers and distributors, including Dublin-based Cardinal Health. Coming up, we'll hear from the mayor of Dayton, Nan Whaley, and also State Senator Joe Schiavone. Both are Democratic candidates for governor in 2018. Attorney General Mike DeWine, who is expected to enter the Republican primary for governor, joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be back.
The big difference between the Dayton and Lorain lawsuits and the state's lawsuit is the absence of distributors. Why didn't the state name distributors as well?
You know, Ann, we're only the second state to take on the manufacturer. So this is not something that, we do very lightly. We completed our examination and made a decision that we had enough evidence to move forward with the manufacturers. We are now in the process of winding up our investigation, or probably a better word is, review of information about these middlemen, and we're going to make that decision fairly shortly. So we're just not there yet, but that decision's coming up.
As you just said, the option's still under consideration. What are the factors that you are considering in that?
Well, it's always a question of what you can prove and what you can prove in court. It's always, what you look at. As you know, I'm a former prosecutor. This is not a criminal case. This is a civil case. Standard proof is certainly different. But, I approach all these cases, as I would as a prosecutor. What can I prove? And it's one thing to file a lawsuit, but you need to at least feel when you file that lawsuit that you have a good opportunity to make your case. And so no one should read anything into the fact that we've not filed it one way or the other. We're winding this thing up. We're going to make a decision shortly, and we'll certainly tell everybody when we make that decision. I made the decision to move forward. As I said, the only second state to have done it, Mississippi, filed a lawsuit a year or so ago. But we just examined all the facts, and frankly, we came to the conclusion that what these manufacturers have done is just wrong. They fundamentally changed the culture. The culture used to be, if you go back as far as pain meds and their use in the late 1990s, they were used really for two things. One is acute pain. Something comes up, you have a wisdom tooth taken out. You take one or two pills for a couple of days, and that's it. The other is at the other end of life when, someone is dying of cancer or has some terminal illness, and, these drugs are used to deal with that person's pain. What the drug manufacturers did is to try to carve out, and they did it very successfully, a whole new segment of the population, and that is people who have chronic pain that is not terminal pain, that is not caused from a terminal source. And so what they did is they targeted primary care physicians. They didn't, it's interesting, they did not really target the specialists. They went right after, your family doctor, my family doctor, and told them that these drugs are not very addictive. They grossly underplayed the addiction, and they overplayed, what benefit these drugs could have on the patient. They did this over a period of time. They spent hundreds of millions of dollars to do it. They did it by having doctors, hiring doctors, and giving them the slides and giving them the talking point, paying them to give presentations to other doctors. They did this by creating third-party groups that is very similar to what the tobacco industry did. They prop up and set up these front groups. They pay for them, and these front groups issue reports that seem to be, impartial, or at least from an impartial source that basically backs up what the drug companies were saying about the fact that these drugs are not very addictive. So it's a long, long process. And what they did is they fundamentally, because of this money they spent and because of the fact that they were saying things that frankly just were not true, they changed the culture. And they changed the culture specifically with your primary care physicians. And that's why we had such a huge spike in the pain meds.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about these lawsuits that have been filed against, in some cases, just drug manufacturers, and others against the manufacturers and the distributors over the opioid epidemic. My guest right now is Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine, who filed a lawsuit last week naming five manufacturers. There's a big difference between the tobacco issue and the opioid issue. According to some analysts, courts have made clear that individuals are largely responsible for their addiction by misusing the drugs. In the case of tobacco, people were using cigarettes or whatever they were smoking, which were legal substances, and they were using it as directed.
Well, I think that's true, but I point out to people that when we talk about the drug companies, what a doctor should be able to rely on the drug company to do is to tell the doctor the truth and just tell the patients the truth. I mean, the drug companies are one who have done the research. They're the ones who know how that product is supposed to be used. What they basically said was they were telling doctors that they should use it in a way that, frankly, we think the evidence clearly was telling the pharmaceutical company they shouldn't be used. So it's an out and out. They took the evidence and they told the doctors, it's okay to use it for this particular purpose, when in fact that had never really been used for that purpose. It was going against what the conventional wisdom was up until that point, and the drug companies went out and just bought their way into changing the culture. And they did it while they knew that these drugs were in fact addictive. It's interesting. If you look at one of the things that they did is when you open up your prescription, many times you'll find all this little fine print and a little packet of information in there. Well, the packet of information that I would bet 1 in 100 people, only maybe 1 in 100 people ever read. That was pretty much the truth. But what they were putting in their glossy pamphlets, what they were telling the doctors in presentations, was not that at all. So the drug companies were saying one thing in their lawyer fine print document they're handing out, and they're saying something else in their advertising.
You're expected, getting back to your question about your comment about not reading anything into the fact that you did not include distributors in the initial lawsuit language, you're expected to officially announce your candidacy for the GOP nomination for governor soon. Some have said that perhaps you've left out distributors in this lawsuit to avoid naming Cardinal Health, which has contributed to your campaign coffers in the past. I just wanted to clarify and clear that up.
Look, that's not why I make decisions. I make decisions on what I think is right. I think people who have followed, my career as Attorney General for the last 6.5 years know that from the very beginning, we were looking at this whole problem and fighting back at this whole prescription problem. And I know some people say, well, I had someone last night come up to me and said, well, you're missing the most important people. I said, who's that? And they said, the doctors. Well, we've taken the licenses of close to 100 doctors who were nothing more than drug dealers, who were bad people, who were doing bad things. What this lawsuit that we just filed is dealing with, though, is pharmaceutical companies who are targeting good doctors who all they wanted to do is really help their patients, and they were getting false information from those drug companies. And so, I've been involved in this for the entire time I've been Attorney General, and I'm going to try to avoid any time I can, any kind of political discussion about this. It's just too. It's much too serious, and it's something that I see every day: moms, dads, brothers, sisters who have lost a loved one to an opiate addiction, whether that is the pain meds, whether it's fentanyl, carfentanil, or whether it is some other kind of opiate. So it's just too serious to be looking at this from a political point of view.
The 2017 Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for the Charleston Gazette Mail outlined a problem in West Virginia with state oversight at the pharmacy board, where it should have been keeping track of and noting upticks, ridiculous upticks in the use and the prescription and the delivery and distribution of opioids in West Virginia, and didn't just put them on a shelf and forgot about them.
Yeah.
Is that an issue in Ohio?
Well, I'm not in a position yet to comment on that. I can't comment about that at this point.
State Senator Joe Schiavone, a Democrat from Mahoney County, has introduced Senate Bill 154, which would allocate 10% of the state's rainy day fund to provide targeted assistance for addiction treatment and prevention programs. This is a more immediate response. Is that a valid use of the rainy day fund?
Yeah, I think it's a valid use of it. That's a policy decision that, of course, the state legislature has to make.
Mm-hmm.
The Kasich administration has not been willing to move forward on that. I think that if we look in at this from a big picture point of view, which mm-hmm. I think is what we have to do, one thing we clearly should do, and I've advocated this and I continue to advocate for it, we should move to every school in the state, whether public, private, charter, parochial, wherever the school is, K through 12, we should be dealing with prevention and education. I was on Reagan's National Commission on Drug-Free Schools in the 1980s, and I would tell you every expert who came in said that's exactly what we need to do. So I put together, along with the Speaker Rosenberger, along with the Senate President, last year, a group of private citizens, some educators, some people in the medical field, and others, to look at the whole issue of prevention. They came back with a report, about a 22, 23-page report, that I would call to any of your listeners' attention. They could call the Attorney General's office. We'll ship them a hard copy of this report, or they can go up online, ohioattorneygeneral.gov, and they can download this report. And what the report said is that we should immediately go every single year to something that is age-appropriate, that has a scientific basis behind it to show that in that curriculum it actually does, in fact, work to lower the number of people who start down the path of any kind of drugs. And that would include alcohol. I sent a copy of that to every superintendent in the state. I hope that anyone who's listening to this program will talk to their school board, talk to their school superintendent, talk to their principal. If your school is not doing that, if they're not doing K through 12, something every single year, I think if I was the parent in that school district, I would be asking, why not? We think this can be done relatively cheaply. We don't think you have to have new personnel to do it. There are curriculums out there, and we have referenced some of them in this report. And so this is a report that people can look at sort of as a beginning document to how we get started in trying to deal with this problem. So I think education, prevention, we got to get moving. We're not moving now. We've got to start doing this in the state of Ohio.
Governor Kasich said that the Medicaid expansion that's in the crosshairs inside the Beltway in Washington has been critical in addressing the opioid addiction crisis. Do you share that opinion, or do you think the expansion should go away? Do you have any thoughts about the block grant proposal being put forth by
I think what we're going to end up with, some of us have advocated a block grant for a number of years. I hope we do get a block grant back, and Ohio will have to shape its own policy. I think Governor Kasich is right when he says that some of the main people that have been helped by this are people with addiction problems. What we're seeing is sheriffs, and by the way, all our county jails are just filled with mm-hmm. people who have a drug problem. They're really our biggest detox centers in the state. And it's just a huge, huge burden and pressure on our
local.
You're
not saying that's appropriate.
But what we're finding, I'll get to the point, mm-hmm. excuse me. What we're finding is that sheriffs are, someone is about ready to get out of jail and go back into the community. They're signing people up while they're still in jail so that they can get this kind of help. And so whatever we do with the block grant, whatever we do in changing Medicaid, we've got to figure out how to keep, to reach these individuals who have an addiction and don't have any other resources to help deal with it.
And I just real quick, I want to just go back to the issue about the the pharmaceutical board and its role in all of this. You said you won't comment on it. Why?
First of all, they are my client.
Okay.
By statute.
Okay.
That creates a very difficult circumstance.
Okay.
That does not mean that we cannot you know, inquire and figure out what's going on. But I've got some prohibitions,
okay,
legal, ethical at this point, about talking about this in any further at this point.
Understood.
And I'm sorry. I wish I could.
I appreciate that. Mike DeWine, Ohio Attorney General, thanks as always for your help today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be with you.
More on responses to the opioid epidemic in Ohio, legal responses, I should say. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last year alone, more than 4,100 people died from opioid overdoses in Ohio. The Columbus Dispatch has reported that early data suggests that that number will be significantly higher this year. States and a handful of cities have responded with lawsuits. We just heard from Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine, who last week named five pharmaceutical companies for their alleged role in creating and exacerbating Ohio's opioid crisis. Yesterday, the cities of Dayton and Lorain filed their own lawsuits that name both drug makers and distributors, including Dublin-based Cardinal Health. In the Ohio General Assembly, lawmakers are pondering a two-year state budget that is expected to set aside close to $1 billion for the crisis. That includes, though, funding for Medicaid. Democrat State Senator Joe Schiavone has introduced another measure that would skim 10% from the state's rainy day fund for addiction treatment and prevention. He has entered the Democratic primary for governor, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
You've written Mike DeWine to praise his decision to file the lawsuit against drug manufacturers. What about distributors?
I think that everybody has some skin in the game here, and I'm glad that the Attorney General has finally moved forward with that lawsuit. I think there may be more lawsuits against the actual distributors, but neither of those things are going to fix the problem today and help the thousands of families that are dealing with addiction. That's why I've proposed this piece of legislation talking about 10% of the rainy day fund to deal with rehabilitation, giving the locals the ability to deal with it on the ground through their police force, through their addiction services, through mental health, and then also making sure that we get everything situated with our insurance and listing what beds are open in what communities and getting a real database so that people in real time can go online and figure out what's available in which county.
What are your thoughts about the cities filing their own lawsuits?
I don't have a problem with it. I mean, let the cities go after whoever they want. If they feel that they have standing, if they feel that they have a case, if they have representation in order to move forward with the cases, go for it. Everybody is responsible for this somewhat, and we have to make sure that those folks that are responsible are held accountable. But in the meantime, those dollars are not going to flow through to help people. We have to make sure that we're doing something in the General Assembly. And Kasich saying that he's put $1 billion into it, I don't think that is exactly accurate.
You, as we mentioned earlier, you want to invest $200 million from the state's $2 billion rainy day fund in Ohio's war against opioid addiction, spend $100 million on treatment infrastructure, such as treatment capacity, that means more beds, and also county-level data collection to better understand the crisis. And I'm wondering, what don't we understand about this crisis yet?
So this database would be set up that would compile reports from each community explaining what we have available,
okay,
what they have
available.
It's
going back to what you said
about
beds.
So that they can go ahead and they can look so everybody knows what's available where. Everybody knows what the waiting list in specific communities. Every community has different needs. Every community has different concerns. And that's why the piece in this piece of legislation talking about the dollars to the local governments is so important, because it gives the flexibility for Franklin to do something different than Mahoning, to do something different than Montgomery. It's really important that we have flexibility at the local level, because as I'm traveling the state, every single community tells me, you know, we feel like we're the epicenter of this problem. And then they give me all these examples of how horrible it is and all the services that are backed up and all the things they're going to have to do to deal with the problem. So it's real important that we have that flexibility at the local level.
Your bill would also require insurers to cover medications that are prescribed as part of addiction treatment. Where is it now? I mean, that's another mandate usually frowned upon in these days. But where are we now? What do insurers, what are they, is it just depend?
Yeah, it depends. And there's a lot of prior authorization and a lot of hoops that people have to jump through when they finally realize that they're going to go forward with this treatment, and the families are pushing their family members in order to do that. And so to remove that prior authorization would streamline the process. But there's also a piece in there that I think is really important, mandating the insurance companies to cover these medications that cannot be crushed, snorted, burned, all the things that they do. These deterrent medications are really important.
Not to, so they aren't abused.
Exactly. Because a lot of those insurance companies only cover certain types, but not the ones that are the abuse deterrent opioids, which are really important because we can't have those on the street.
We heard from Attorney General Mike DeWine, who talked a bit about education as a form of prevention. And your bill would call for $2 million from the state's general revenue fund to provide grants for prevention education. Now, I'm wondering how targeted these would be in terms of the topic area, because Mike DeWine talked about all drugs, you know, talking about all different kinds of drugs, including alcohol, and how to prevent abuse of those. What are your thoughts about that?
I think most schools have something, but as I'm traveling and I'm meeting so many experts that are so knowledgeable, and they want to get into the classroom to talk to kids about the effect that these drugs have on their brains and the effects that these drugs will have on their ability to be successful in life. It's really important that we get these kids early when we're talking about opioids, when we're talking about heroin, when we're talking about these serious drugs. Of course, alcohol, marijuana, all that stuff's important. You talk about everything together. But I think today, the focus must be on opioids and heroin, because that is what's devastating our communities throughout the state. And kids need to know. Some kids are already seeing it at home in real life, unfortunately. But to get into the schools at an early age, talk about how this affects your brain and your thought process is really important. Not just scaring kids saying don't do drugs because we say it's bad.
You also want to create drug take back programs at local pharmacies. What are the obstacles to doing that?
I don't think there's that many. It's just, hey, let's do more of these. Some, you know, we do, Attorney General does some of these and calls for some of these, but we should do these almost every week, every month, whatever it might be. Get these drugs off the streets that people are not taking for their prescriptions and get them back into the hands of, you know, the pharmacies and people that can destroy these safely. Get them off the streets. These things are dangerous, and it's more and more people are finding this out. You know, as I'm a workers' comp lawyer, and I represent injured workers, and there's so many times that I saw somebody that was prescribed these medications for a torn rotator cuff. Doc said, hey, look, take these pills. It'll help you with pain relief. They end up getting addicted. And then the BWC cuts them off, and they don't know what to do. So they spend down all their money in order to find it on the street. Don't have any money left for that, turn to heroin. It's happened multiple times that I've seen with my own eyes. It's powerful. It's scary. It's unbelievable. And it ruins people's families. And so we have to deal with this problem now.
There's a fundamental issue here about how we deal with pain in our society. This isn't a developing country problem. This is a developed country problem. We have access to these drugs. We can afford to pay for them, all things being equal, until it becomes gets out of control. But there's also that fundamental issue of pain and what we're willing to live with.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the courts will determine whether or not the manufacturers and the distributors sold the people a bill of goods, right? Told them that these were non-addictive pain medication therapies. They'll have to prove that. But I've seen a lot of things that in other states where I know Kentucky settled for $24 million with the drug company. Now, $24 million, 3-4 years down the road, I'm not sure what that really does in order to help the problem. I mean, eventually it will. But today we have to do something. And, you know, alternative pain management therapies are really important. You know, go to your chiropractor, go to physical therapy, take some of those non-addictive oral medications, injections. There's a bunch of different ways to do that. And, you know, in the field that I was in as an attorney, I saw a lot of ways that we would try to get people into those therapy plans that did not include OxyContin once we realized and saw how addictive these pills were.
Joe Schiavone, Democrat, Ohio senator, Democrat in the Ohio Senate, I should say, also a candidate for governor in the Democratic primary for 2018. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Of course. Thanks for the opportunity.
Joining us now is Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley. The city of Dayton has filed a lawsuit on its own. Welcome to the show, Mayor Whaley.
Good morning, Ian. It's great to be on.
You included distributors in your lawsuit. Why?
Right. We wanted to make sure that every link in the chain that's responsible for this epidemic that has hit our state and our city is held responsible. There's a few doctors in there as well that were culpable with the manufacturers and the distributors. And so we included everyone that we found to be responsible for this epidemic that's hit our community.
I did get a chance to ask Senator Schiavone this. I did talk to Mike DeWine. He is legally represents the State Pharmacy Board. But in West Virginia, they found definitely a pattern of behavior in the Pharmacy Board of ignoring all the data that was coming through and all the reports. Once even the distributors were required to start reporting or following the law there, they still ignored it. What about Ohio? Do you know much about that?
I don't. It's something we're looking into. It wouldn't surprise me, considering how flat-footed the state has been on this epidemic that has been attacking our communities for years. Dayton was one of the first cities in the state to declare a state of emergency during the first year I was mayor in 2014. It's something that's staring us in the face every single day, and we've seen very little help until lately from the state on something that local communities have literally been dealing with hand-to-hand on the ground every single day for these past 4 or 5 years.
Attorney General Mike DeWine says that he is considering adding distributors to the lawsuit. They're just working on crunching the numbers at this point and the legal arguments. Now we're talking about multiple lawsuits from cities and the state. It's possible that other cities will follow suit with Dayton and Lorain. Is that an efficient way to go after this?
Well, I mean, I think you just really see how alone communities have felt from the state. This is just another example where the state has not had any real relationship with our communities, hasn't really included us in any of the discussions. You know, the Ohio Mayor's Alliance for the past year, we started last November. This has been an issue that mayors have been talking about and acting on for the past year together, right? And so you have to ask yourself, you know, we filed yesterday. You know, we're like a little town, right? So that we got ours together, we're able to move forward as quickly as we did. It really makes you wonder where the attorney general's been these past few years on this, considering the other states that have filed.
How is it manifesting in a city like Dayton? I guess another way to ask this is if you won the lawsuit, if you won a bunch of money, millions of dollars, whatever it would be, what would you spend it on?
We would spend it on the hand-to-hand work that police and fire are doing every day. This June, we will see more opiate-related or accidental deaths in Montgomery County and in the city of Dayton than the entire year last year. Cities across the state have seen a surge. We thought 2016 was the worst year on the books for the state and for cities, and we're seeing an increased 30 to 40% above that in communities across the state. So our police and first responders are exhausted. The work that they're doing, we're having to invest in peer-to-peer counseling just for their, you know, state of mind. Imagine if you went to run after run after run and saved a person's life every single hour, every 2 hours. That's what's going on the ground with our first responders. And that's costing our community a lot of money because we're doing those calls instead of being able to deal with the other calls in our community. It is an exhausting effort on the ground and one that we have just gotten very little help or even a hearing from the state until as of late.
A lot of people listening, the calls come in whenever we talk about this, which is often these days. They say, what about the user? Why not give them personal responsibility for this? Anyone can look and know that if you have to get it illegally, it's probably not something you should be doing.
Well, and I think that's one of the issues for us and why we're holding the drug companies accountable. In the 1960s, people that were addicted to opiates, 80% of them started with heroin.
Mm-hmm.
Today, 80% of people addicted to opiates started with prescription drugs. There's a fundamental difference about what's going on here. And while I respect people wanting to talk about education, we've been doing that for decades as well. And the surge that communities have seen that happening right now, this is a very big difference. And you can tell it was done handedly by drug companies, and it started in a way where people thought they weren't doing anything wrong.
Dayton Mayor Nam Whaley, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Ann. Have a good one.
That's the mayor of Dayton, Nam Whaley. The city of Dayton has filed its own lawsuit against both manufacturers and distributors in the state of Ohio that are allegedly play a strong role in creating and exacerbating the opioid epidemic now in Ohio. One of the top states in the nation, more than 4,100 Ohioans died from unintentional drug overdoses last year. It's a 36% jump from the year before. Coming up, we're going to talk about the origins of the drug crisis. Someone says that it started in Ohio and how that expanded to heroin use, the likes of which we see today, every day on almost any street in America. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 4,100 Ohioans died from unintentional drug overdoses last year. That's a 36% increase from the year before. And early data suggests that the number of drug overdose deaths will increase again in 2017. Journalist and author Sam Quiñones has written about the inception and trajectory of the opioid crisis in the United States in his book entitled Dreamland, the True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. He joins us now. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
We have heard from Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine, who filed a lawsuit against five pharmaceutical companies for their alleged role in helping create and exacerbate Ohio's opioid crisis. Also, Nam Whaley, the mayor of Dayton, which in addition to Lorain, has filed its own lawsuit, which includes distributors. West Virginia, which has one of the highest opioid overdose death rates in the nation, filed its own lawsuit last year. Charleston Gazette-Mail reporter Eric Ayer has been covering this issue for some time. This year, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his investigation into West Virginia's opioid crisis. Welcome, Eric, and congratulations.
Oh, thanks very much, Ann.
Your investigation reported how drug companies shipped nearly 9 million hydrocodone pills over 2 years to one pharmacy in the town of Kermit, West Virginia, population 392. I've asked Mike DeWine, Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine, about the role of the pharmacy board in Ohio. You looked very deeply at the role of the pharmacy board in West Virginia. What did you find?
Well, here, the pharmacy board had a law in the books that was intended to flag what's called suspicious drug orders. Those are orders of large numbers of pills from pharmacies to the distributors, and we learned that they hadn't been enforcing that for years, for more than a decade.
What did you find out why? I mean, what were the explanations? Were there any?
It was a change of executive directors. The board has since also changed over. It's made up primarily of independent pharmacists. It was they classified it as something that wasn't on their radar.
Sam Quiñones, we've talked before in your book Dreamland, the True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. You sort of go down, you know, to very granularly down to where this all started and how it started, and you pinpoint a place in Ohio, Portsmouth, for that, which is where Dreamland, which was the name of a day park with a swimming pool, you know, since closed, you name it for that. When you hear about this role of the pharmacy boards in this, that could have been a stopgap right there, right?
I suppose it could have, although, I mean, yes, certainly. But it's also a much bigger story than that. You know, this is a story of pharmaceutical marketing. It's about pain specialists who early on rightly believed, in fact, that we did a very poor job of treating pain and developed almost a kind of a revolutionary fervor to change that and to push the idea that we should be using these pills far more aggressively. Doctors, I'm sorry, should be prescribing these pills far more aggressively. So this is There are some stopgaps, but the truth is too that and maybe those stopgaps weren't there or didn't work early on. But also, this is about our own desire as Americans to have doctors magically fix our pain and quickly and without a whole lot of complications. So it's a far more a complicated story than simply one state's pharmacy board not quite fitting their responsibilities. Although certainly something like that might well have helped.
Eric Ayer, what did you learn in reporting for the Charleston Gazette Mail in your work about that piece of it, about the individual piece, and about our relationship with our doctors and our relationship with pain?
Well, we have the same thing here with the pain clinics that Sam points out in his book so well. We had basically, our pain clinics were unregulated until about 3 years ago, and then they went in and started inspecting them, and we saw these incredible stories of clinics that were essentially the doctors weren't there. They were there on paper, but they weren't there physically. They had hired retired cops at a couple of the clinics, and the cops were using machines to churn out prescriptions that had stamped signatures on from the doctors. So it really was the biggest problem out of the gate was the pain clinics. And the people that would go there, of course, would pay cash only. They would have arrangements with specific pharmacies. The other pharmacies, like some of the chains, wouldn't accept the prescriptions. And it just was particularly a problem in southern West Virginia, and it kind of filtered out throughout the whole state.
You know, Sam Quiñones, over the time and since we talked last year and every time we seem to talk about this, at least one person calls in and says, what does prescription opioids have to do with this heroin epidemic? What if we just built a wall between us and Mexico? Wouldn't that keep them out? You explain it really well in Dreamland. What happened? Can you give us a thumbnail?
Well, I mean, people grew addicted to these pills because they were vastly overprescribed. For example, after most routine surgeries, even today, people are sent home with 30 days, sometimes, roughly that, I think, most of the time, worth of pain pills for pain that's going to last 2 or 3 days. A lot of that, some people grew addicted overusing those same pills they were prescribed. Some of those pills made their way out into the black market, and you now have people buying them, so they created a black market on the street, a vast supply. These are doctors all across the country for 20 years prescribing this after routine surgery and other ways. And so people, these pills contain drugs that are chemically very similar to how their cousins to heroin. They're all opiates. And you get addicted to one, you begin to, and you're particularly a drug like OxyContin that for many years had no abuse deterrent. So it would take your addiction up to very high levels per day. And it's unsustainably high for financially, you couldn't pay for it all. And so people began to look for heroin. And this switch has happened first, really, in the area we're talking about, West Virginia, Southern Ohio, et cetera, those kind of very roughly drawn that area. Mm-hmm. But now, of course, you see this happening all across the country. And so we have a heroin problem today because of vast overprescribing of opiate painkillers, particularly OxyContin, and then people looking for a very cheap and just as potent, if not more so, alternative, which is Mexican heroin. And so these two things together, the problem is that we face, and answer your second part of your question is, all of the heroin coming that we use today, virtually all of it comes from Mexico, but all of it's being smuggled through areas that already have walls. More walls will not stop this heroin from coming in. It's coming in through areas, through Tijuana, through Nogales, through Juarez, various places, where we already have walls. And this is the problem we've created for ourselves, a very difficult thing to combat, because it's frequently heroin is trafficked in small quantities. It's a very easy and very profitable drug to traffic in small quantities, 1 or 2 or 3, 5 kilos, not big truckloads, hundreds of kilos. That does happen. But I think that more and more, a lot of people see how easy it is to traffic and make money at trafficking in small volumes. But again, those people are coming through areas, walking through, you know, border checkpoints and so on, that already have laws.
Charles in Lancaster, you're on the air. Hi, Charles. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to split hairs between the terms overprescribing and indiscriminate prescribing of controlled substances.
So you're talking about the pill mills opiate versus a doctor who's just making sure you're not in pain.
The issue is if someone comes in and you're treating them for 7 months for back pain or knee pain, and you're giving them the right amount of drugs, but you're doing that on a long-term basis, you're going to lead to dependency, mm-hmm. which will probably lead to craving. Then you lead to this term called addiction. And what I'm getting at is that the doctors are trained in pharmacology to repackage inserts and to know about what leads to addictive behavior with a medication or dependent behavior. This is the ones prescribing medicines. No one else is doing it. This is a problem created by physicians. And I think doctors have had such an aggrandizement in society where I guess they don't want to be questioned. But it's something that really should happen, because physicians get dependent on this as an income from patients. And they don't want to cut those off.
Charles, thanks a lot for your call. Sam Quinones?
I think, it's a long, long topic that your caller brings up there. I think that on one hand, there's two kinds of pain, right? There's acute pain, and which is post-surgical pain. And I think in that area, we have been massively over-prescribing for 2 decades. I've talked to numerous people this happened to, where you need pain medicine for 3 days mm-hmm. after your surgery, and you get 30 days worth of pain.
So right.
That is all across the country for 2 decades now. Now, chronic pain, which is what your caller is referring to, is a different thing. And I do not believe in the pendulum swinging all the way back to where it was, where we just cut people off and no pills for anybody. These pills actually do have a very good role in medicine. I do believe that this is a conversation that has to take place between the doctor and the patient in the privacy of the clinic. And it's a complicated, nuanced thing that we don't deal well with on 5 minutes of talk
mm-hmm.
radio.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I do believe some patients really need these pills and are doing fine with them. Others have had their lives, basically, they don't feel pain, but they can't do almost anything else. And so finding a solution that is kind of a nuanced solution is a difficult thing to do in our society. We don't do that well. Our pendulum seems to swing from one extreme to another. And it would be a shame if people understood what's happening now and decided that the solution was to say, okay, no more pills, just cut them off. That seems to me to be getting back to the original problem, which was that we didn't use them at all for fear of addiction, and lots of people were in real agony because of it.
Eric Ayer, could you give us a sense about, sometimes it's hard for people to imagine the number of pills that were moving into these very small towns. What did you find in your research?
Well, we found that the overwhelming majority of pills were going to southern West Virginia, in particular, a lot of small towns. We had one in Kermit, West Virginia, with population 392 people, and they were receiving, in a two-year period, they received nearly 9 million pills, and over 4 years, I think it was over 12 million pills. Now, this is hydrocodone only, the numbers of OxyContin were a lot lower. But you just had these enormous quantities. There was other cities that had not quite that amount, but mm-hmm. Other cities that had, or I should say towns, that had just these enormous numbers of pills that were being shipped into the...
Into just single pharmacies, some of them.
Yeah, and the thing we found is a lot of them were independent, sort of mom-and-pop pharmacies. It wasn't the chains. We found cases where you'd have a chain pharmacy that, let's say, was shipped 50,000 OxyContin per year. Well, there'd be another independent pharmacy down the road, in some cases, within eight city blocks, that was receiving upwards of 2 million, 3 million OxyContin per year.
About a dozen West Virginia towns, cities, and counties have filed lawsuits against the drug wholesalers, or announced their intentions to do so since December. What's the sense about that? I mean, what's the sense about what West Virginia got out of these lawsuits as it is?
Well, there was a state case that was filed in 2012, mm-hmm. and in that case, they received $32 million combined.
Right,
from
not a lot.
Wholesalers. And now, since that settlement, as you just mentioned, there's been a number of cities and towns that have filed their own litigation against the drug wholesalers, and in some cases against pharmacies and doctors. I know Ohio had the manufacturers sued. We actually, in West Virginia, they sued Purdue Pharma back in, I believe it was 2001. They settled in 2004 for $10 million, which to Purdue Pharma is absolutely nothing.
It's a grain of sand, right?
Yeah. And one interesting thing we've learned recently is the drug companies are, particularly in this case, the distributors are fighting back very strongly against these lawsuits. They've since hired two prominent federal prosecutors from West Virginia, one from the Northern District and one from the Southern District, to represent them and to try to tamp out these lawsuits before they spread even more.
Sam Quinones, it is, pardon me, always interesting to know about the what all of this depended on. In the beginning was a paragraph or two in some report somewhere that says that these weren't very addictive drugs.
That was part of what happened. Sure, it's not the only thing that happened, but that paragraph in the New England Journal of Medicine that you're referring to was used, which said that a doctor in Boston had checked his database and found that of 300,000 patient records from hospitals, 11,000 plus of those patients were given narcotics while in the hospital. Very important distinction. Mm-hmm. And only four of them got addicted. He wrote that up. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. He probably forgot it because it wasn't that important. Just kind of an FYI. And yet that was then taken as a proof, as evidence, that these pills were virtually non-addictive when used to treat pain. And it was used by pharmaceutical companies and by pain specialists to help convince doctors that they should now very aggressively be using these pills because science now knew that these pills were non-addictive. And that is part of, it's not the whole story,
right,
by any means, but it's part of the story of how we came to believe that opiate painkillers, which we've known as a species, we've had contact with for 5,000 years as mm-hmm. the human species has, we convinced ourselves that somehow these pills would not be addictive in that. And then, of course, all nuance was thrown out the window and everybody could have all the pills they wanted, and we began prescribing them en masse to people all across the country.
Sam Quinones, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sam Quinones, author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, and Eric Ayer, State House and Investigations reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner for the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Ann, for having me on.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher.